Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Mike Volpe to the broadcast. Mike is a general partner at Index Ventures, where he helped establish the firm's San Francisco office. As a partner, Mike is responsible for investing in early-stage companies with a focus on open-source and SaaS-based companies. Prior to Index Ventures, Mike was the chief executive officer of Juiced. Before Juiced, Mike held multiple executive positions at Cisco Systems. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in Medical Engineering, his Master of Science in Manufacturing Systems Engineering, and his MBA from Stanford University. Mike currently serves on the board of 16 public and private companies, including Fiat Chrysler. I recently caught up with Mike by phone from his office in San Francisco, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as Mike shared how he focuses on the founding team and individual entrepreneurs rather than the sector when making an investment. Principle 2, infrastructure, as he discussed the benefits of open source software, including security and flexibility. Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Mike discussed how the role of IT has evolved as every department within the business is becoming more fluent in technology. And Principle 5, external partnerships, as Mike shared how Fiat Chrysler is partnering with technology firms such as Waymo to develop its autonomous driving capabilities. We also discussed the enormous impact autonomous vehicles will have on the world, including legal, regulatory, and technology challenges associated with autonomous vehicles, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Transmit Security. Transmit Security designs and develops platforms that address problems in security and usability by making it easy for developers to implement advanced authentication techniques ranging from biometrics to behavioral profiling. As the risk of cyber attacks and hacks increase, companies need a more effective way of preventing unauthorized access. I recently caught up with the Transmit Security CEO, Miki Budai. This week, Miki highlights the tremendous upside to developing a network of expert advisors in various areas of technology and the surprising willingness of top experts to provide free advice.
The third advice is around advisors. The CEO and the CIO of HSBC have built a board of technology advisors consisting of market experts in various fields of technology. This is a brilliant idea. You'd be amazed how many top experts are willing to share their knowledge and provide free advice. There is absolutely nothing for you to lose here and so much to gain. You can take the advice, you can reject the advice, you can have a think about it. But once you put a bunch of smart and experienced industry experts in a room and just brainstorm, you can validate or invalidate your directions and open your mind to other views as well.
Tune in next week when Miki discusses partnering with startups. Volpe, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter.
Great to speak with you today. Appreciate you taking time. Mike, I thought we'd begin from your role as a general partner at Index Ventures, a firm you've been with since 2009. I would love to cover a few of the different categories of technology in which you play. One of the ones that is most prominent, and from my perspective anyway, most interesting, is autonomous vehicles. You are an investor in this space, or you've invested in and sat on the boards of startups in this space. You are also on the board of Fiat Chrysler, so you see this from multiple angles, both digital native and digital immigrant, so to say. And I wonder if you could take a moment and talk about your perspective there with both of those in mind, and perhaps tune towards where are we in the grand scheme of things. This has been something that's been talked about for many years. Now we're starting to see a lot of innovation actually become reality. But would be, as somebody who is so deeply immersed in this, would love kind of a bird's eye view from your perspective as to where things stand today.
Yeah, happy to share some thoughts. Look, at a high level, I think there are two important messages to kind of take away, which I'll dig in a little deeper on. The first is that the technology and its use of it is enormously transformative and important to the business world, various segments of the industry and society in general. I'll start with the last point. You know, there are 38,000 deaths in traffic accidents in the United States every year. If you zoom into a place like India, it's closer to 500,000 deaths a year. And the promise that this technology brings about to change that and to create a much safer environment for people to drive around in is incredibly important. It also has a wide variety of ancillary benefits, from the reduction of parking lots to the value and the creation of urban driving environments, commute patterns, traffic, et cetera. There's a lot of really good societal benefits that come about from this technology. It's incredibly important in that, from that perspective. It's enormously transformative to the automotive industry and all the industries that are associated with it. Because, you know, for about 100 years, production of cars has been all based around the experience of driving. And that experience will, over time, go away. And people will, you know, sort of like people ride horses for fun, but not really professionally anymore, except for a few competitors. I think someday that same will be true of cars, that the experience of driving a car won't be central to the purchase of a car anymore. In addition to which, because self-driving in all likelihood in its mature state will be a much cheaper way for vehicles to be driven around, you can imagine that for a lot of the ride-hailing companies that we talk a lot about today, the Ubers and BDs and Lyfts of the world, will be, you know, heavy, heavy consumers of autonomous driving technology, and it will change their business models too. So, you know, this is an enormously important technology, and I think that there's a great deal of validity to the attention and scrutiny it's getting in the market today, because it's hugely impactful. So that's one key point that I think is important in the takeaway. The other key point, however, in the takeaway is this is an enormously complicated and complex technology, and it still needs a long time before it reaches maturity. I was educated as an engineer. I worked as an engineer for some period of time, and now I'm a business person. But one of the things that you sort of have to do as a venture capitalist is to really try to objectively evaluate how ready some technology is. And self-driving is not ready. It's not ready because it requires many, many different forms of technology to come together. Some of the technology is very advanced, both on the software side, so the artificial intelligence and machine learning components of what we're doing are very cutting edge, and I would say had some transformative changes in the 2014-15 timeframe that make them usable for self-driving, but still very early. And even some of the technology that's required for perception, so the eyes and ears, if you will, of the self-driving cars, technologies like LiDAR are also extremely novel and young. And so, A, you have an immaturity of the technology. B, you have to integrate all of these different forms of technology. And if you take it even in its most basic form, a car that drives itself has to, first of all, see the world. So it needs eyes and ears. Those eyes and ears have to be integrated with the creation of a map of the world as we understand it when we're driving. And then we have to make a bunch of decisions about where we want to go and how we want to get there. That's how a normal driver works, and that's how an autonomous car works. So these piece parts need to fit together very tightly. And because each piece part is evolving very rapidly and at a very different pace, and it has to be loaded on a car, which has a 15-year life cycle, the readiness of all these pieces coming together is not there yet, and it'll take a while. And so, you know, I think that there are a lot of numbers that are thrown out there in terms of the time frame to which this technology will be ready. It's a few years for sure, and it will also depend on where these vehicles are used. Because if you go in a very predictable urban environment, let's imagine like a city like Phoenix, where you have principally straight roads, you have principally good weather, and you have, you know, high tolerances, so meaning the roads are wide and they allow for a lot of space. Driving in such a place is much, much, much easier than driving, say, in a city like Boston, where you might have weather and particularly snow and sleet, which are very tricky for self-driving vehicles. You might have crazy traffic, crazy shaped roads, and very low tolerances. And those situations are much harder for a self-driving car. So if you say like, oh, when's a self-driving car going to be driving around the city of Boston? I'd give you a time frame more like 4 years plus. Phoenix, maybe a couple years, year and a half, something like that. And if you go abroad in some parts of the world, like let's say any of you have drone around India, it might be even much further out than Boston. So there's a gradations of time, but definitely a little ways out before we see a mainstreaming of the technology.
One of the hurdles that companies will have that will be at least a portion, aside from the more important step of the technology itself and its readiness, is the regulatory environment and the role that governments will play in helping or hindering the progress made there. And I wonder if you can comment a little bit on that, progress you've seen made, issues that may still be around, and especially as we see even like the reaction to in the grand scheme of things, the relatively few accidents that have happened, but when they do happen, the one might argue outsized response from governments as a result.
Yeah, well, it's obviously a very complicated thing to legislate. And so there isn't much in the way of legislation right now. There is a great deal of scrutiny. And as in all things that come with regulation, there are different sets of incentives that occur in different geographies and denominations of that regulation. But I do think that there will be some form of regulation. And at the end of the day, it's likely to represent some form of the equivalent of a driver's license. So if you think about us humble human beings in the United States, when we're 16 years old, we get the privilege of having sort of a temporary driver's license, which we're allowed to use. And then when we're 18, we get a full driver's license. In order to get that, we have to pass a written test and a driving test. There's going to be something equivalent to that for self-driving vehicles at some point. The complicated part of it is, how do we define a driver's test for a self-driving system? Those frameworks will need to be defined by somebody, and whether they are defined state by state in the United States or at the federal level, there's a great deal of complexity and unknown there. And so it's going to require a good deal of collaboration between both the technology providers in the space as well as the OEMs in the space that will also need to work with these regulatory bodies to make this happen. But there is undoubtedly some important regulation that's going to come about in the general scheme of things here. And that will also take time because of the underlying complexity of the technology.
Also, naturally, this literally is giving up control. And there's been a lot that's written as to, how close to perfect does it need to be before people are willing to give up that control? I wonder if you have a perspective on that, especially since, of course, the transition, it's not as though, at least we don't anticipate that the change is going to come such that all vehicles right away are going to be, have all the relevant technology. So there's going to be for perhaps a long period of time, a hybrid of, traditional vehicles on the road and as well as autonomous vehicles, which in some ways makes the job much more difficult than if it were a society where all vehicles were autonomous and had access to each other's sort of data as to where they are going and so on. And I'm curious, I guess there are a couple different veins that I'm getting to here, but one, the extent to which in your mind the technology needs to be, as close to flawless as possible. And secondly, I guess related to it, the difficulty of getting it there in an environment that is this hybrid between old technology and new technology.
Yeah, I mean, so it's an excellent question that you ask, because if you think about human drivers today, there's a certain number of deaths that happen in the United States a year, 38,000, I think, last year. And there's a certain number of miles driven. So I can give you a ratio of how many miles driven per deaths in the United States. And that's an understood phenomenon. And as a society, we accept that we say like, okay, that's enough. That's a good enough trade-off. Whether it's morally right or not, I don't know, but we do accept it as a society. So the question is, what's an acceptable comparable ratio for a self-driving vehicle? Is it one less death than you would experience with human drivers, or is it half, or is it a quarter? And those numbers are achievable, actually, depending on both how much infrastructure you put into the car. So, you know, the more sensors you put in and the more computing power that you put in, the lower the incidence of accidents, of course, but the higher the cost of the vehicle that results. And then the caution with which these self-driving systems drive, you know, can they exceed a speed limit, for example, or, you know, how many unprotected left turns do they make? Those types of things are also parameters that we can control. And what's acceptable from a societal perspective around that is totally unclear. And we don't have parameters or heuristics around how that, you know, will get decided. So, you know, I think those are the things that the regulatory regime will have to wrap its arms around and make the decision. And, you know, it's obviously not, you know, it's not one person's opinion, although if you can save even one life, I think that should be enough to roll out the technology. But we probably will have, my guess is, higher expectations of AV than we have of human beings, and substantially higher expectations around that. To your second point about mixed environments, humans and autonomous vehicles driving together, I think that that's going to be reality for the next 30 years. I don't think you can ever remove the ability for a human to drive for the foreseeable future. So that's something that the manufacturer, the creators of the self-driving systems will fully expect to work. And there may be some, you know, city state somewhere in the world, maybe a Singapore might, you know, sooner than that decide that there's no human drivers. But I think in the United States, for example, that's just not a realistic worldview for the time being. So you're going to have mixed environments for a long time. Hopefully, you know, self-driving vehicles will be designed and built in such a way that they can accommodate for that readily.
Mm. I also would love to understand your own thought process, again, as someone who's on the board of a traditional automaker, as opposed to just on the boards of startups who are bringing innovation to this space. And I can understand you can't necessarily get into the deeper knitting of Fiat to Chrysler necessarily, but I, by extension, I would love to understand your own perspective as to the amount of creativity, investment, and mindshare to autonomous driving and the technology behind it that you see emerging from Detroit, from the auto industry, the traditional auto industry worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I serve on the board at FCA, so, you know, I measure my comments by not even being an employee, just a director of the board there. What I would say, if you look at what they've publicly announced, they've developed a partnership with Waymo, the subsidiary of Alphabet or Google. They are procuring 60,000 plus vehicles to Waymo to produce self-driving systems on their Chrysler Pacifica platform. So obviously they believe in it, and they've selected what they perceive as the market leader to collaborate with. I would say that a traditional auto manufacturer sees a evolutionary path to AV, which is to say that, you know, today we have so-called level two or level three systems that are becoming available or are available. Those are generally categorized as driver-assisted systems, so they help the driver do a better job driving, whereas level four and above systems, which is what, you know, one of our portfolio companies, Aurora, is building, those do not require a driver. And there's a big transition there. Most auto manufacturers will see that they will continue to create vehicles that go up that level two, three, four ladder over a period of time. They all view it as important, and they all view it as clearly a technology that they need to embrace. They do have different perspectives on how they choose to embrace it. In the case of Fiat Chrysler, clearly they've elected a pathway to partner with providers of the technology because they view that as outside their current core competence, and one in which by partnering with best of breed, they'll produce the best results. In the case of some of the other ones, they have decided to either develop the technology in-house or acquire entities which own that technology and sort of control it very close to their core. That represents the importance they associate with it, and B, obviously they believe that they could do a better job than somebody who's providing multiple players in the industry. You know, not surprisingly, as a director of FCA, I tend to agree with the FCA view of things, that, you know, partnering with folks is the better approach in the short term. Other people hold different beliefs to it, but I tend to think that there's no denying that all auto manufacturers believe that this is extremely important and transitional. Now, all of them want to bleed it in to their fleets. And then, you know, the core question is whether they do it themselves or partner. And, you know, you're getting different outcomes on that in that dimension.
So, Mike, I wonder if you can lend some perspectives as to how cities may evolve as a result of some of what we're describing. You know, there are those who say that cities, in many ways, have been constructed based on, of course, the assumption of traffic, the assumption of driving, the assumption of ownership of vehicles, given, you know, major parking lots and garages and spaces that litter the landscape. And I wonder, with the evolution that you've described in terms of not only how the technology for automobiles will evolve, but also even how ownership will evolve. We may reach a point where very few people choose to own vehicles because of how readily available they are whenever we need them. If you put some thought into how cities themselves may change as a result.
Precisely the nature of how urban design will shift isn't something that we've spent a ton of time thinking about, but the reality of that is very clear. As you said, you can immediately see that traffic patterns and urban design will change a lot. You know, you will have very different dynamics around parking lots and where vehicles are located. Self-driving vehicles, in theory, can go away for a while or serve other people and not need to be located in the near proximity of the driver. So you can start thinking, whether it's a personal service or whether it's part of a ride-hailing fleet, these vehicles not sort of cluttering particular urban areas in order to just be in the proximity of a driver. One kind of interesting statistic that I've heard is that the average utilization of a given vehicle in on the roads today is about 4%. So 96% of the time it's sitting parked somewhere. And obviously that will change with autonomous technology. You will also see an environment where hopefully people and cars can coexist in a safer manner. And so parts of the cities that are designed more for a vehicle / human being friendly manner could be certainly part of reality. The other sort of interesting part is when you start to think about the majority of fleets being autonomous, you can see traffic patterns designed in very different ways. You know, for example, if you have a freeway system, you know, today largely the allocation of the lanes is fixed. Because you assume that there's a certain number of vehicles coming one way and going the other way. But if humans aren't driving, those can be completely dynamic. So they can, you know, lanes can be adjusted based on the needs of the traffic flow at that particular time of day or particular time of the week. So you could see some very significant changes in traffic patterns as a result of that. You also have a situation where, you know, people can become more productive because if you're being driven around, you can do other things while you're in the vehicle. And so you could see significant shifts in productivity, and maybe people will choose to live in slightly different places. And probably the most relevant one is that autonomous driving is likely to bring about a much lower cost to the consumer of being moved around. And like any other commodity, when prices drop, people use more of it. So you may encounter an environment where people are moving around a heck of a lot more than they are today, because there is a burden, a friction, if you will, to the cost of moving. So I think we can envision a lot of different kinds of changes, some of them that we'll learn along the way. I don't think we're going to necessarily know those a priori, but I definitely see a very, very different world when self-driving vehicles become the majority of the fleet that's out there.
I'd like to turn our attention to the software infrastructure space, the so-called plumbing of technology. There's a lot that has evolved here, and especially as is relevant to, let's say, digital immigrant organizations as opposed to digital native organizations. You have, you know, the legacy of the hard iron infrastructure within their space. There's now the opportunity to mimic some of the magic of digital native organizations who more recently had the blank slate to choose as they wished from a technology perspective, to say nothing of a people skill perspective or process perspective as well. But the migration from there to here for those older organizations can be quite an undertaking, both in terms of time, expense, and simply just change management, et cetera. And I wonder if you can take a moment to just reflect on where you see infrastructure evolving and the extent to which you have insights into how some of the older line organizations, how successfully they're making that move.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's going to be no surprise to your audience when as I describe the fact that their technology infrastructure is dramatically transforming in every dimension. There's a few high level points that I would kind of underline though. One is that, you know, back when I started in the technology business in the 90s, technology itself was the domain of the IT department. And the IT department provided technology to other parts of the organization and they used it. And I think if you look at it today, because of the shift that's happening where technology is pervasive in both our personal lives as well as our professional lives, every part of an organization is now a participant in the usage and the selection and then the embracement of that of technology. So, you know, as a provider of an enterprise technology suite, you used to just talk to the IT department. Now you got to talk to all parts of the company, and every part of the company is a buyer. So that's an important shift. And that means that for enterprises all around the world, every department, every organization is now needs to become fluent in the usage of technology to create a competitive advantage for themselves. That means the human resources department, the customer services department, the engineering department, of course, finance organizations, marketing organizations, product organizations, salespeople, every part of the organization now will have technologies that are built for them, and they become the customers. And obviously, IT organizations become the partners to them in the usage and deployment of it. So that's an enormous shift. It's just happening. You're going to see a lot more technology being designed, not necessarily specifically for the IT department, but for other parts of the organization. That's an important shift. The second shift, of course, is that there used to be a very high tax that was associated with the deployment of technology, which was an IT department had to build servers and storage and networks and all sorts of kind of low-level infrastructure that was needed for the basics of running a technology suite. Today, that's changed. You don't need to build the plumbing anymore. You can just sort of assume that the plumbing is there. It's called cloud. And what you need to focus on is the real value that is fundamentally being created for your organization. So it's far, far more important right now to focus at the application layer as an organization rather than worry a lot about, you know, how many servers do I need and where do I need them and how do I deploy them and how do I manage them and how do I obsolete them and so on and so forth. So really the attention is over time focusing more and more on the application layer and the whereas these sort of clouds, the Amazon and the public clouds in particular, the Amazon clouds, the Google clouds, or even, you know, organizations own private clouds, the value, there is value in having those, but they are fundamentally plumbing that, you know, most people don't need to worry about anymore. So those are massive shifts. Some organizations, again, will try to deploy and continue to deploy some amount of private clouds that they need to have for a variety of reasons. Others will elect to go largely with public clouds. You know, the growth of Amazon, Azure, and GCP, the Google offering, would clearly indicate that in large numbers, people are migrating at least portions, if not substantial portions, of their infrastructure to clouds. And that's an irreversible trend that will continue. And those organizations that have chosen to move things to public clouds or, you know, outsource clouds of some variety will continue to focus their efforts in the areas where they gain competitive advantage from technology. And again, I'd emphasize that a lot of that will be at the applications layer. So those are the big, big themes that I'd say. I'll pause there for a second and maybe we can, you know, dissect that further. But those are the things that I'd say are most important right now.
Yeah, no, all makes sense, certainly, and certainly sort of a lot of what I'm seeing as well. I want to actually go a little bit deeper into software as a service and some of the evolution there. I know you've got some specific, like industry-specific insights as to how SaaS is evolving from some of the areas in which you play. But I also, I'm curious sort of how you see adoption and use, and as well as like creativity and innovation on the provider side evolving from a SaaS perspective?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously SaaS is the only area, which isn't the only, but most applications these days that are being developed are SaaS, of course.
Yes.
I would say that there's the first generation of SaaS software that we saw emerge were aligned with the primary functions in a corporation that is a customer. So salespeople were some of the first to adopt the SaaS CRM, principally offered by Salesforce. Then you saw marketing technologies that developed into SaaS. You saw finance solutions. You saw customer support solutions, human resources solutions, IT solutions, and so forth. And each one of them gave rise to one or two very large players, a Salesforce, a ServiceNow, a Workday, a NetSuite, and so forth. I think that those companies obviously occupy a very strong position, but there are a couple, two or three key areas, I think, that are still on an evolutionary path. One is that, you know, there are multiple other, perhaps smaller functions, though, that exists in a corporate environment today that are still in the process of adopting SaaS. I'd give you an example. One of our portfolio companies is Zuora. Zuora is a provider of SaaS-based billing system. You know, billing is kind of a finance function. It's kind of a sales function. It's kind of a marketing function, but it sits in between. It's not one of the major groups that you would think of in your company, but billing is very, very important. And relationship management for subscription is very important. That's a space that Zuora occupies, and they've become a nice, mature, publicly traded company serving that portion of the market. And there are many, many other white spaces that exist in the SaaS world that aren't the major functions of an enterprise that can still get adopted. So that's one important thing. The second is that there's still a very wide chunk of software that exists on-prem around enterprise resource planning. There's a lot of organizations out there that run, you know, Oracle SAP type ERP solutions. And those solutions are heavily, heavily customized by large system integrators. And I think that those will gradually be replaced by SaaS offerings, maybe by those incumbents, maybe not. But I think you will see a lot of these kind of legacy applications, highly integrated, highly customized solutions that go by vertical industry, be transformed into SaaS solutions. And I think the sort of calcification of those old school ERP systems will be challenged over the next decade. And then the last component of SaaS that I find interesting is that you know, the first generation of software as a service providers did great work. Salesforce, Workday, et cetera, did very good work. But if you tear those things apart and look at the innards of it, their basic construct is that they have a large database with a UI on top of it, and there's rows and columns. And I think that, you know, you will see challengers emerge to those Gen 1 SaaS providers that will attempt to kind of innovate around that using technologies like machine learning or AI to augment, enhance, improve what the first generation of SaaS providers do. Some of the incumbents will respond to that and provide their own variants of it. Some of them will remain unchanged and will face some threats and challenges from new providers of that technology. So lots of room to innovate and expand. And I think SaaS will continue to be one of the most interesting segments of the enterprise for the next decade.
Very interesting. Another area you play deeply in is open source. You're on the board of multiple open source companies. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about the trajectory of open source, as well as the evolution of the business model. This is one of those where the technologists were consuming heavily of open source technology before they necessarily were engaging with the companies that were emerging as open source organizations. And maybe, and I know, you know, firsthand, a lot of them were sort of confused as to what really is the business model for those who would provide that. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about each.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's interesting. Our firm started investing in open source technology, you know, almost more than 10 years ago. We invested in a company called MySQL, which turns out to be a very popular database these days. I would say even from back then, but you know, even today, there's a lot of people who are skeptics around the notion that it's a business at all. I would say a couple of things. Open source has really changed as a movement, and as a construct for the building of businesses around it. It obviously started with kind of a community rejection of closed source software. It started with operating systems and the creation of Unix and its derivatives like Linux. Those pieces of software were developed, in fact, by the community, similar with one of our original investments, MySQL. And the business models that were constructed around that were essentially just support subscriptions, where companies like Red Hat or the company MySQL itself would basically provide support for those open source projects. But if you fast forward to today, two big things have changed. One is that open source projects themselves are less sort of community created, and it's really more built by companies. So if you look at popular ones these days, things like Hadoop and its derivatives, which are built by companies like Hortonworks and Cloudera. Elasticsearch, which is built by our company Elastic, which we're an investor in. Kafka, very popular open source project built by Confluent, MongoDB, et cetera. So you're seeing these projects that are very, very intimately associated with both from a, not just from a support perspective, but really from a creation perspective with companies. That's very different. And what results with that change is that these companies really are at the core of the roadmaps and the evolution of the technology, and therefore they are better suited than the former variants of open source to have predictable roadmaps and timeframes and exclusive knowledge of that software base, and can better monetize the open source technology than ever before. And because they are companies, they are much easier for customers to deal with, because it's the one throat to choke. If you want a particular feature, you can call the people at Elastic and say, look, I'm not going to pay you more until I have this feature. And that's a much easier type of relationship for customers to have with their vendor. And also, these open source companies are less and less purely open source and becoming much more open core, meaning that you have a core of software, which is obviously in the open source domain, but around it are a variety of components, which are proprietary software, and customers have to pay those vendors for the use of those proprietary elements. So you really are becoming, these companies are becoming hybrid vehicles between open source and proprietary software. Still a great deal for customers, but a little more easy to monetize. And you are seeing more and more open source companies achieve success in the public markets as a result, whether it's a MuleSoft, a MongoDB, a Hortonworks, a Cloudera. These are all multi-billion-dollar projects that are out there, a multi-billion-dollar company. So clearly, they are becoming real business. The last component that I talk about in the context of open source, though, is that increasingly, particularly for the deep infrastructure side, so whether it's, you know, data analytics, databases, message buses, et cetera, enterprises are kind of expecting that open source is the way to go. And so it's much less likely that you see a financial services company or a healthcare company or a transportation services company actually select proprietary software as their core infrastructure, in part because they're tired of their vendor lock-in that they end up in those situations, in part also because, you know, seeing the software gives them a great deal more comfort And also from a security perspective, when you think about it, you know, a priori you would think like, well, open source is less secure, but open source has been tested and tried a whole lot more than proprietary software because it's out there in the public domain. So a lot of companies are beginning to realize that open source software is even more secure. And so from a lot of dimensions, I think you're seeing a movement where it's very unlikely that the next generation of core infrastructure software elements are not open sourced. And I think that represents a giant change from where we were 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, very interesting. I also wanted to ask you, Mike, you spent a formative period in your career with Cisco, holding multiple roles there, including chief strategy officer and also SVP and GM of one of the businesses within Cisco. And Cisco is one of several, you know, a handful of Silicon Valley companies that a lot of venture capitalists have emerged from. And I wonder if you can reflect a little bit about what it was about that experience that helped provide you with the kind of skills and background that would then become appropriate in your current role at Index Ventures.
You know, Peter, it's interesting. I joined Cisco back in 1994. And if you go back in history a little bit, 1994 happens to be the year that a company called Netscape launched its web browser and web server. And I didn't join Cisco with the mindset that I'd end up in venture capital. I joined Cisco with the mindset that the internet might become a big thing, which it's turned out to be, thankfully. So, things worked out in that context. I do think that the big lesson there is that when a major technology shift is happening, like the creation of the internet, like the advent of broadband, like the creation of the mobile computing environment that we all enjoy today, like the migration to cloud or like autonomous driving, when those big shifts happen, you see a lot of people who are innovators, risk takers, who want to take a chance for a big change in the world, migrate to that space. And so I was very lucky in my early days at Cisco to be surrounded by a group of people who were risk takers, innovators, who wanted to do things differently, who saw sort of the world being a different place as a result of the things that they were doing. And in some sense, it's not surprising that, 20 plus years later, those people who had that mentality, that pioneering mentality, have ended up doing a lot of interesting things. And some of them are obviously venture capitalists. Some of them have led companies and done a lot of really fun stuff. But the core is that, when you're in a place that a lot of interesting technology waves are hitting, it's not surprising that a lot of capable people surround that environment, and those people end up doing amazing things. And I think my real fortune was that, I saw something amazing happening with the internet and the web. I went to one of the companies that was kind enough to give me an opportunity to work there. And sure enough, I got surrounded by a bunch of incredible people that are still my colleagues and friends and are doing amazing things now, some in venture and otherwise. So I think at the heart of it is that when you see, the beautiful thing that we've developed in Silicon Valley and increasingly adopted around the world is when something exciting and happening is happening out there, you can take a skeptical view and say like, well, it's not going to happen for a while, or, oh, it's a bunch of hype and oh, this, oh, that, be, sort of glass half empty about it. Or you can run into it and embrace it. And often what you'll find is when you run into it, embrace it, you're going to find a very special group of people that are around you that will become your friends and colleagues for many years to come.
That's wonderful. I also wanted to ask you briefly, Index has a few different sort of not what people might think of as non-traditional investments that the firm has been a part of, one of which you were a board member to, and that's Blue Bottle Coffee. And aside from being a native of Italy, and therefore, coffee, I'm sure is sort of naturally in your DNA to be a passion, a point of passion. I'm curious about your own perspectives about investing in the coffee space.
I would say that our Blue Bottle investment is definitely an exception that proves the rule. It's certainly not a core competence of ours, and we are very fortunate. I would think I'd kind of give you this this perspective, which is that, being a venture capitalist, oftentimes we get asked the question of, what sectors do you invest in and why? And it's a relevant question. I wouldn't say it's not relevant, but it's important to note that the thing that really makes a business go at the end of the day is the entrepreneur. Especially when you're an early stage investor like us, I think, you know, these days something like 70% of our investing is Series A investing. What you tend to find is that businesses shape, evolve, change, to adapt to, what the market needs and wants. And a lot of that adaptability and velocity of change is dependent on the entrepreneur. So generally speaking at Index, we do have areas that we like to invest in. We like to invest in cloud and enterprise and SaaS. We like to invest in marketplaces. We like investing in the fintech space. We've done a lot in games in the past, actually. We love the space of mobility these days, like whether it's autonomous vehicles or electronic scooters, electric scooters. You know, we see a lot of exciting stuff happening in those areas. There are areas we don't invest in. You know, we haven't done a lot in life sciences, for example. However, the thing that drives us the most at the end of the day is finding that special entrepreneur that sort of identifies the same trend we does and then does all the smart things to kind of create that. And Blue Bottle, in some sense, was totally off theme for us. And it's not likely that we'll ever do another coffee investment again. But we did find an extraordinary entrepreneur in Brian Meehan, who was leading that company. And we'd known him for a long time. And sometimes, you know, as a venture capitalist, you have as much conviction about the person, the founding team, as you do about the space, and you're betting on them. And I think if there's one important takeaway from that investment for us, it's not that we invested in the coffee business, although we're happy that investment ended up being a very good one for us financially. The more important thing is that we followed the instinct of, you know, great entrepreneurs. And, you know, a lot about venture capital, you know, you ask us, you know, opinions about how we think, what sectors and so forth. But in truth, you should be asking us whether certain people are great entrepreneurs or not, because the true judgment of whether we see success or not is often relying much more on the core founding team and what they're able of doing rather than specifically what sector they're in.
Very interesting indeed. Well, Mike Volpe, thank you so much for joining us on the forum on World Class IT, sharing your perspectives across a variety of different areas of technology. It's been a great conversation.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you for having me on. It's great always to talk to you.
Likewise.
If you like what you've heard, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Mike Capone, the Chief Executive Officer of Qlik. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.